Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Len Serafin. She was born in Brooklyn and now resides in Bedford, England. She is an author, transformation personal coach, a speaker, community leader, and on the book side, she's one of Amazon's best-selling authors. She uses her expertise to inspire and help people reconnect to themselves. In the course of her life, she has done extensive studies of music and religion in India, and she's the founder and leader of the Global Wellness Circle, a holistic education project. Well, that's enough to get on with, Lynn, isn't it? Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, except that bio is 2 years old.
Is it?
Yes, and there's a lot of changes. The Wellness Circle actually ran its course, and I dissolved it about a year ago because I started something else. And really, what I do now is book promotions, Michael. Okay. I am an author. I'm still a coach. I do all of those kinds of things. Nice. But what I do is I work with spiritual authors and mind body spirit authors to get the word out, basically to develop their online platforms and spread their messages and really step into their life purpose through their writing and their art. So that's really what I do now, and I'm pretty much as my speaking platform now is on spiritual marketing, pretty much. But yeah. So, and on lots of other things too. I still talk on Garden of the Soul, but I have another book coming out next year or in about 6 months called The Seven Graces of Marketing, which it would surprise people very much because it's really about looking at the subtle ways that media messages and marketing have impact us on a personal level, on a societal level, and how not only as a so-called consumer to be aware of these things, but also as a business person who if we know that there's something wrong with the state of marketing today, what can we do about it? What's the new paradigm to make the world a better place and get away from all the things that we intuitively know are wrong, but we haven't necessarily been able to quantify or to analyze. And so the book is really, it's about that in a way.
Right.
In a nutshell.
So. Yes. Well, you still have this very varied background, which we can talk about, and also your views on spirituality. But just on a point of interest here, which some of our American listeners would no doubt like to know, is when did you move to England, and what brought about the move?
Okay. Everybody asks that, you know, and in Britain, I've been here since 1999. What brought me here originally was my ex-husband was English, but I was living in Phoenix. We were living in Phoenix, Arizona. Our daughter was 16 at the time. And I really fancied a change. I felt like our lives had gotten stale. No, nothing against Phoenix. It's just I'd been there 14 years and it wasn't where I knew I needed to move. And it was a lovely place to raise our daughter. And I needed a change. I also knew our marriage was on the way out. And I said, well, if we're going to break up, I want to break up someplace new. And I had been to England many years before, but only very, very shortly. And, you know, I knew – oh, and I'd been to Europe a few times, and I knew that I liked Europe in general. And, you know, I'm not – even though I've studied lots of languages, I'm not terribly fluent in any of them. So I wanted to be in an English-speaking place. So we came here, and I absolutely loved it right away. I just felt so at home right away, and I really am bonded with Britain. And I'm now a dual citizen. I mean, I've broken up with my husband since then. That's actually part of the story of the Garden of the Soul, you know, part of it, a small part of it. But coming here, really, some people say you have a spiritual terrestrial home. And there was something about Britain when I came here. Maybe it's the history, you know, the the buildings, the ruins, the grounds, the old forests, the smell of the earth, the beautiful daffodils in the spring. There's yes. something about Britain that I just adore, and I love it here. And I'm finally my wanderlust, because I've lived so many places. I'm almost 56, and I've lived so many places, and my wanderlust has been satiated. I really like living in Britain. It's a lovely. I love the people. I love the country.
Right. Do you think something in the attraction that you feel for this country might be because you've lived here before?
Who knows? I mean, if I didn't live here before, then, you know, it's at least that something does happen to me when I go to historical places, and I can feel the energy in the places that really just grabs me. Like, for instance, even here in Bedford, there was a very, very big castle here. It's not here anymore. It was torn down 1,000 years ago, you know. Right. But back then, I mean, it was a huge civil war, because it was very, very powerful, and the king didn't care for it very much, and they tore the thing down. And so the only thing that's left is this big hill and a few bricks, a few stones in the wall right. that were laid there. And the roads in the area were from, you know, Roman times.
Yes.
And there is another place where there's, again, rubble, you know, ruins of an old Roman settlement. And you go and you... What happens to me is when I see these stones, I put my hands near them, and I just say, somebody cut this stone. Somebody took it from the earth. Somebody cut it. Somebody laid it here. And when I come to these places and I feel this, I feel such a connection to bloodline, you know, just to the as a human, maybe not me in another life, or maybe not ancestral, who knows, but as a human being, yes, that this is, you know, I've inherited this from the human race, and I feel so connected. Another thing that connects me in Bedford, and this is really it may sound kind of silly to some people, but to me it's really important. There's a river that runs right through the Bedford. It's the beautiful Great Ouse. It runs more or less west to east, and because of that, I can always tell what direction I'm facing. Now, I grew up seriously. Yeah. I grew up on Long Island, New York. I always knew which way was north, south, east, west. I could start talking like a New Yorker if you want me to, but I won't. But I always knew which way was north, south, east, and west. And when I moved to London with all the big buildings and all the windy roads, I couldn't figure out where the heck I was. You know, it was just and when I came to Bedford, the river, I can always sense where the river is. Even here, I'm sitting in my flat. The river's maybe half a mile away. I know the direction the river is in. I know what direction I'm facing. And believe it or not, that grounds me. I don't know if other people have that experience. I have spoken to some people that that's true. I'm very much affected when I don't know which way I'm facing. I don't mean every second, but I mean in general. Yes. I like to know where I am on the earth. Like right now, I'm sitting here, and I know a very strong sense of the fact that you're out in Kent, and if I reach my right arm down, I'm facing north, and if I reach my right arm down, that I'm waving to you, Michael.
I'm waving back. Kent. Yes,
waving back. There you are. And Kent is beautiful, isn't it? It's lovely.
Yes, indeed. Mm. Yes. Oh, well, that's interesting to know the reasons why you're there.
It's a bit eccentric.
And why you're going to stay there by the sound of it. Now,
let's
just talk a little bit about your background here. Why did you do the extensive study of music and religion in India?
Okay. Well, we're talking about a long time ago. When I was I was originally a classical musician. I was a symphony violinist, and I went to further my studies in. I grew up in Long Island, and then when I was 18, I went to a conservatory in Boston, and it was actually New England Conservatory, and I was there, and the environment I found very oppressive for many reasons. I'm not going to blame it on the conservatory. There were lots and lots of reasons why. Some of it has to do with my parental home and all this other stuff that was going on at the same time. I couldn't handle the environment. It was too cutthroat. It was too too much critiquing. I couldn't handle it. I was very sensitive, and it really, really unnerved me. Then, when I was about 20 or so, I saw a gentleman. His name is just, you know, sometimes you have teachers who change your life, and I think there were three teachers in Boston who actually changed my life. One was my theory teacher, one was my world music teacher, and one was an art history teacher who I mentioned in my book, The Garden of the Soul. Now, the world music teacher, his name was Peter Rowe, and he opened my eyes thrillingly about world music. And I started analyzing and transcribing music from China, Japan, music from India, music from the Middle East, and all things. And I started adoring world music, and I decided that's what I was going to go into. So I changed from being, kind of straight violinist, classical violinist, somebody really getting into world music. I left Boston because I couldn't handle it anymore. I moved down to Texas, believe it or not, and I lived there for 9 years there, Michael. I lived in Austin for 7 years. I lived in San Antonio for a couple of years. That was actually because I eloped, and that was really just an escape, and that was what I call my practice marriage. It lasted about a year and a half. And I was very young. I was 21, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was just trying to run away. And it broke up because it had to break up. It was not destined to last. But I stayed in Texas, and I studied at University of Texas. I studied Asian languages. I started studying Hindi. I studied Sanskrit, believe it or not, and I studied Bengali. And then I really wanted to get more into Indian music, and because it wasn't much in Texas, there was some Indian families and some new sitar, but I couldn't learn anything. So I got a grant to study in Calcutta when I was 25, and that's what I did. I went and I studied in Calcutta, and I stayed on my own. It was, my parents thought I was crazy. They thought I was going to be killed, you know. A woman, a young girl on her own, traveling in India, blah blah blah. And I had no, at that age, I had no thought about anything like that. I just went, and I studied violin. I didn't learn terribly a lot, but it was a very influential trip. When I came back to Texas a few months later, I actually met the man who was later to be my husband, and the father of my daughter, and he played Indian tabla. So I said, I want to go back to India, and he said, well, I'd like to go to India, and he had already a connection with Indian spirituality, and I was kind of dabbling in it.
Yeah.
So when we went back to India, I got another grant, and we went back to India to study. We stayed a longer time. He learned a heck of a lot of drumming. I learned very little music. I ended up immersing myself more in the spiritual side. And there is a story in the book. I won't go into the whole thing, because if you want to read it, you can read it in the book, where we actually meet who was to become my guru for 20 years. Wow. And it's a kind of a mystical story how we found it. It's like one of these cases of looking for something and it wasn't there when you went to go find it, and then you found something else, and then later you found the other thing. It's a very mystical story, and you know. So I have no doubts that all of that was meant to happen. My connection with the Indian temple lasted more than 20 years. I, myself, with my ex-husband, we started an organization in the West to bring that teaching into the West. We coordinated, or I did most of the coordination, I have to say, at least 5 or 6 world tours for our guru to go speaking in all around the United States and in England, and coordinated also with the Europe. And this is also how I started getting back into my writing, because when I was a child and a teenager, I was a very, very avid poet. I wrote a lot. And it was only when I got married that I stopped writing, because my husband didn't like my poems, and I didn't like being criticized. And so in a cliche way, I stopped doing what I loved to do, because I wanted approval and all the kind of toxic things, the toxic habits that we pick up.
Yes.
So I started actually kind of semi-translating and definitely transcribing audio lectures that our guru was giving, both in India and in the United States, and they were very inspiring. They were in English, but they were mixed with Sanskrit and Bengali words. And I knew, because of my background, I knew enough to translate and to cross-check the words that weren't all in English, but the majority was in English. And my guru, I did one translation. It was on the Bhagavad Gita. A lecture on the Bhagavad Gita was very beautiful. And this was back in 1996, I think, or so. And he read it, and he said, "Why did you leave the language exactly as I spoke it?" I said, "Because you're the guru. I don't want to change your words." He said, "If you're going to put this in writing," he said, "your English is really good. You have a mastery of English." He said, I don't want you to write it the way I said it. I want you to write it the way it's supposed to be written." So he gave me permission to start being an editor. And I didn't realize at the time that this was the beginning of me becoming an author that I was meant to be. And I transcribed two books, really. Well, I transcribed one fully and another one I copy edited, and two others I did editing on. So I say I ghost wrote the first one because it really was, it pretty much was all my writing. You won't see my name anywhere on it because it was all done as a ghostwriter. And that was, I learned so much about good writing from that. I learned so much about retaining somebody's voice. I learned so much about expression and expressing in words, because I'd been so out of touch with writing. I'd been doing music for, you know, the past 25 years, and I hadn't been writing much. And around that same time, the marriage broke up. Long story short, it was a violent marriage for all of the duration. It was a very violent marriage, a lot of physical abuse. I suffered injury from it. And longer story short, when the marriage broke up, my connection to India also broke. And so did my connection to music. And again, I talk about this in the book, so I'm not going to go into the whole story. But what it opened up for me at the age of then, I have to think back what year that was, 2002, which I was 47. What that opened up for me was a blank slate. I was living in London, a country I wasn't even a citizen yet. I became a citizen that year. And with a daughter, a 19-year-old daughter who was going to university, living there on my own. London's one of the most expensive cities on the face of the earth. Trying to survive, growing my life back over again, not doing music anymore. And I rebuilt my life from nothing. Really, I had really nothing. And it was quite a journey. And the things that happened to me even in the first year, the reality of realizing how physically ill I had been before and how well I was getting simply by allowing myself to unfold and evolve and become this whole human being. It was astonishing. I talk about this quite a lot when I talk. I talk a lot about the mind-body connection because I had been suffering in the marriage. I never told anybody about the abuse, you see. And I only talked about it when I made the decision to end it, or right near that time. And a lot of people didn't believe me, and that was a real struggle. A lot of people thought I was covering up for something wrong I had done. People started saying, "You must be having an affair, and you're just trying to point the finger at him." And that was really, that was a challenge. Boy, was that a challenge. Yes. And it's absolutely everything I needed to bring me where I am now. Because what I learned from that entire experience, I can't even count the amount of things I learned from the pain from that period of time. What I learned was, number one, like I said, I had fibromyalgia, almost a crippling case of it, and heart palpitations, panic attacks, all kinds of things. Back then, and whiplash, which I didn't know I had until even years later. All of those things, and they all went away as I started to step into myself. So that's the one thing, the mind-body connection, or the emotional and body connection. That was profound. The other thing was I really, really, really learned what keeps us in unsatisfactory situations, what keeps us disempowered, what keeps us unhappy in life is because 9 times out of 10, at least in my work as a coach, I see it in my life and in my client's life, it's fear of other people rejecting you or other people judging you. 99 times out of 100. That's the primordial fear, is of being left out, of being abandoned. And judgment is a form of abandonment. Now, I was abandoned. The temple I was with turned their backs on me. Mm. And if it hadn't happened, frankly, I'd have still been... It was absolutely essential that they abandoned me. Mm. Because if they didn't, if they hadn't, I'd have been holding on. I'd have felt not myself. I wouldn't have allowed myself to evolve. And bottom line, I wouldn't have learned that this is the lesson I was supposed to teach. The lesson I was supposed to teach people was, it's fear of judgment that is keeping you from letting go. It is fear of judgment that is keeping you in this space of not being in your authentic self, your true self, your full self, the hero that you were born to be. That was the message. And I was thick enough to not learn it unless I got kicked. Some people learn it without being kicked. I didn't. And now I am grateful every day that every single thing that happened. People say, how can you be grateful that you were a battered wife for 22 years? Well, damn it, I am. That's the lesson. And when I speak to people, of course I am. This is a whole story. If you're watching a wonderful movie about a hero and he goes into battle and he has all these struggles and he's injured and then he gets up in this and then he wins at the end. And if you say, well, let's take out all of the battle. Well, where's the hero? I'm not saying we have to suffer, but what I am saying is we are whole stories. And the book really is, The Garden of the Soul anyway, that book, my first book, which was published in 2009. It's almost 2 years old now. It's 2 years old since I wrote it, but it's almost 2 years since I published it. That book is telling people, I'm hoping it's telling people, you're already the hero of your own life. That's the opening lines to the book. You're all ready. You don't even have to do anything. You're already the hero of your own life. Step into it. If you don't, no one's going to do it for you. And if you resist, you'll be born again and again and again and again until you step into your own life. And what we think is karma, it's laws of cause and effect, blah, blah, blah. You know what? That's not my definition. That's not my understanding of karma and dharma. My understanding of karma is this. Karma is simply things that we are holding on to. Simply. That's all. And as soon as we decide that we will let go of them, we don't have them anymore. You want instant karma release? Let go. Let go. And then it's gone. You have people have no idea how powerful this is. It's simple. You want to be happy? Decide to be. Decide to be happy, and it happens right away. And I found this out. And this is why I had to do what I'm doing. Dharma, on the other hand, which some people translate as duty, your spiritual duty, ethical duty, responsibility. Actually, dharma, to me, my understanding of it, and I know this is true, is your life, your soul's purpose. That's all it is. You have a soul's purpose, and that's your dharma. And until you live your dharma, you won't be happy. And until you let go of things, you'll carry that karma which keeps you from living your dharma. You let go of karma, you live your dharma. It's easy. And it's easy to be joyful. And that really is the entire message of the Garden of the Soul. And you know, I do it in a specific way. I have a certain kind of way I do it, but that's really the message of it. And that's really when I go and speak to people on that subject, that's what I talk about.
Right. What did you make overall of the religious teachings in India? I mean, did they sort of resonate with you?
To be honest, some did and some didn't. And like anything, it was interesting, Michael, because what happened is that when I met my husband, one of the first things, just because I was interested in India and I was reading lots of philosophical books, didn't mean I wanted to be connected to anything. And, you know, I had been brought up in an organized religion, and I didn't want it anymore. And I said that. And that was one of the first things I said. I said, me and organized religion, we are not companions. You know, we don't go together. Right. And he said, I agree. But then it happened. And we got, you know, established with them. And so what about the teachings? I couldn't deal with the organization. I could not deal with any. I'm a free spirit in that, okay? But the messages, some of the messages I still carry, some of them still resonate with me. For instance, there's one concept. It's a more philosophical concept. The concept if you've ever heard the band Kula Shaker, they did a song that say this in Sanskrit, Achincha Bheda Tattva. Sorry, said it wrong. And what that means is that truth, tattva, truth, divine truth, ultimate truth, truth with a capital T, truth is inconceivably, in other words, you can't think of it with your brain, truth is inconceivably both one and different. Now, if you don't know, if that needs further explanation, this is really the further explanation, is that truth, spiritual, real truth is not something that we can analyze with our brain. And real truth is the presence of all paradoxes. Real truth can be both dark and light at the same time. Real truth can be, you know, dead and alive at the same time. You know, real truth is all. Real truth has no limitation. If you think that that there's a divine force and that there's any parameters around that divine force, it can't be absolute. Absolute means that you have to allow for the fact that all paradoxes exist simultaneously within that. Therefore, the truth, that what the saying is also saying is about our nature. Our nature is we are simultaneously one with God and different and separate. We are both. And I actually, to me, that makes sense because we know we're divine and at the same time we're separate, not meaning that we're separate ultimately, but we are like different facets of the diamond. You know, you're on this, you're this facet, I'm that facet. Your facet has a different color to mine. You know, we reflect different shades of light. We reflect different densities of light and color and shadow and whatever. That is what makes creation beautiful. Creation is like a diamond with an unlimited, if you can imagine what unlimited is, an unlimited amount of facets. And all of these facets together make this brilliant existence. I mean, it's an analogy, it's as close as I can come to explaining what truth is. In the Garden of the Soul, I use that imagery of the diamond, of like a kaleidoscope. If you can imagine a kaleidoscope that is continually turning and the patterns are continually changing. And when you see that patterns are continually in a state of change, you realize there actually are no patterns. There are no patterns because it's in constant change. And it's only our desire to want to hold on to a specific pattern that gives us the illusion that's a pattern. And that's really where we are in this life. Our bodies, who we think we are at this point, this is an illusion of a pattern that we want to hold on to. However, at the same time, there's some beauty in taking a moment and looking at that pattern and saying, isn't that lovely? So it's very similar to quantum science, where they say, is it particles or is it waves? Well, the particles are the patterns. The particles are the frozen images of the kaleidoscope. But the fact is, they're never stopping. They're never stopping. It may be a snapshot, but they're never stopping. So you could say equally, it's all waves. Therefore, it's all part of the same. It's all the same. So Achincha Bheda Abheda Tattva means reality is not just inconceivably, but spectacularly and beautifully the resolution of all paradoxes because they all coexist at the same time. And you don't have to try to sit anymore and try to figure out what truth is. That's the beauty of that statement. You don't have to sit and think, what is true? Who is God? What is this? Is there a heaven? Is there a hell? You don't need to think about that anymore. It doesn't. These are all just parts of that kaleidoscope. They're not important. Reality is all things, and that, and then when you say that, you can say, I don't know, and say it with a smile, and say, actually, to say I don't know opens me up to knowing everything, if you understand what I mean. And
yes, but I think sometimes, Lynn, where people have perhaps a very strict religious upbringing, those type of questions are bound to come up when they start to think more deeply for themselves. They presumably have to sort of clear that out of the way before they can perhaps project their focus on something else.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you've read St. John of the Cross's Dark Night of the Soul, that's actually what you're talking about. The Dark Night of the Soul, I mean, it's a Christian mystic book. All right, Catholic mystic book. And if you read it, it's very, very similar to Eastern mysticism, extremely, if you really understand both. Because what he's saying is that he talks about the dark night of the soul and about the – it's actually kind of later in the book where he's actually talking about meeting the lover. So it's about – it's about the devotion to the lover. It's about devotion to God, or divine, or whatever you want to call it. And he's talking about stealing out in the middle of the night when everything is quiet. If you read, there's a scripture in Sanskrit called the Srimad Bhagavatam, and they talk about something called the Rasalila. And also there's a story of the Buddha doing the same thing where he leaves the court. These are all metaphoric explanations for the same thing. What they're talking about is stilling all of the falseness, all the mental analysis, all the stimulation, all the judgments, all of the things that are coming from our temporary understanding of things, stilling those. So that's that being asleep. And then going, stealing into that night and looking for the lover. That's when it happens. And it does happen when we feel like we're in that dark night, when we're empty. He talks about emptiness. And actually, I've come to understand what emptiness means. Emptiness means that you're just not full of your own crap. Sorry to use that word. But it's true. Emptiness simply means that you become like a vessel. You become like a vessel into which things can be poured. And this is part of what I haven't mentioned so far. In the Garden of the Soul, there are four principles. They're give, receive, become, and be, all right? And I'm actually talking about all of them here. What I'm talking about now, about the emptiness, is receiving. You cannot receive. You cannot receive divinity. You cannot receive wealth. You cannot receive health. You cannot receive happiness. You cannot receive anything without allowing yourself to be empty enough to bring that in. There is a story in India. You talk about India. This is a story that I do take away. There's a couple of things I take away because they resonated with me and they make sense to me on an absolute level. If they're only about this is the only way, doesn't get me. These stories resonate with me on an absolute level. Here's a story I want you to hear, and this resonates with me. And I tell the story in the book because this was a story my guru told and it does resonate with me. He said he was talking about a festival in India called Janmashtami. You might say Christmas here in the States, or in the West, I should say. I'm not in the States. So, you know, but here in the West. And because it's a similar idea, it's the Janmashtami is the birth of Krishna. So it's similar to Christmas, and that is the birth of Christ. So it's the birth of the divine on the earth. It's the divine becoming incarnate, or however you describe it, appearing on the earth. So it's the day that you celebrate for that. So they're similar in that way. So he was talking about how do we prepare for this? We prepare for this by cleaning the temple and, you know, wipe the temple down. We put the flowers on and this and that. And he says, but actually he said, that's just the external thing. What is necessary is for us to clean the chamber of the heart. Think of the heart as a room, as a chamber. If you are, and he was talking about the fact that we were chanting. In India, we chant names, you chant mantras aloud. You're singing, you're chanting. Yes. So you're chanting and you're calling God's name, you're calling God's name, you're calling God's name. He said, imagine that you're in your room and you're calling your loved one. You're calling, please come, please come, oh, please come, 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 please. And you, and they come to the door, and your room is full of furniture, full, so full that you've got tables and beds and chest of drawers, everything up against the door. Just the room, you can't even move. Just imagine this room just packed like a warehouse with furniture. So you're calling, lover, come, come, please come, please come. And lover comes to the door, knocks on the door, tries to get in, can't get in. And he says, he comes. He hears you calling. He comes. And he goes away disappointed because there's no way to enter. And he says, this is the process of connection, spiritual connection, to empty that chamber of the heart so that when you actually call God, instead of saying, why doesn't God come to me? Well, the fact is, he does, she does, it does, whatever. Divinity comes, source comes, spirit comes. But if your heart is not empty like a vessel, if you have a vessel that's full of mud, you cannot pour nectar into it. If you have a room full of furniture, the lover comes in, he can't, she can't come in. This force cannot come in. So the dark night of the soul, which is Catholic, and the Bhagavatam, which is an ancient Vedic thing written in India, and even if you read certain Sufi texts as well, they all say, all mysticism says, it is about emptying. And even Zen talks about being empty. Empty. When you empty, then the truth comes in. That's when it comes in. So what do you empty yourself of? You empty yourself of angers that are pointless. You empty yourself of guilt that's pointless, of self-judgment, of judgment of others, of fears. And if you cannot empty them, then you have to dive into them. And that's what the dark night of the soul is. It's about diving into those emotions that have gotten stuck and really finding them and then allowing them to go.
Right.
And that's when it clears. And they're all the same, Michael, really. Mm. When you really get to them, mysticism, if truth is true, this is my belief. If truth is true, I say it in the book, if truth is true, it has to be true at all times, in all places. If it's only true in one person's religion or another person's religion, I don't buy it.
No.
So I only take the stories that I can apply to anybody. It doesn't matter what religion they're in. And what or what religion they're not in, or even if they're an atheist. You don't have to believe in God to know that you need to be empty to fill up with joy.
Right. I absolutely agree with you on that, I must say. Now, time is passing by so rapidly. We've still got another 10 minutes. I need the last few minutes to announce next week's guest. But what I'd like to move back to are the four flowers.
Sure, you bet.
The first one was receive, wasn't it?
No, it's give.
Give, beg your pardon.
Give, receive. The flowers are the rose, which is the metaphor for the principle of giving. The iris is the metaphor for the principle of receiving. The daffodil is the metaphor for the principle of becoming, and the lily is the metaphor for the principle of being. So those are them. So what would you like to know?
Well, the point that occurred to me, and I think it's covered by those four that you've mentioned, is that to receive, you first have to give, and that particularly applies to the energy of love.
You can't say what's first, because it's like this. No, and actually you have to think this. How can you give if you have nothing? You cannot give if you have nothing. People who go around feeling they have nothing, people who feel, I give, and I get nothing back, and I feel so impoverished, and I feel so jilted from life, they're not giving because they feel they have nothing. If you want to be a tremendous giver, you must be an even better receiver. Because if you want to give, you have to be able to receive enormous amounts of whatever it is, you know, enormous amounts of spiritual energy, of health, of wealth, of abundance, of fame, whatever. You need to be able to receive all of these things in order to be able to give. If you have nothing, you can't give. So to say that one is first and one is the other, it's prana, Michael. Prana means breath, yes? Like pranayama.
Yes.
you can't say that in order to inhale, you have to exhale first.
No.
Or exhale, you have to inhale first. They're connected. They are connected. They are intimately connected. And that's the great paradox. You can't say this kind of thinking is linear and this kind of thinking is material. When we say this is first and that's next, this is creation means reality means it's all simultaneous, simultaneously one and different. Simultaneous. Giving and receiving can't exist without each other. They're not opposites. They're not opposites. They're parts of the same thing, of the same flow.
Right.
The flow of energy from me to you. I breathe out carbon dioxide. The tree breathes it in, breathes back oxygen to me. Who started it?
Yeah.
I can't tell you. That's giving and receiving. And giving and receiving also has to do with expression. Giving has to do with self-expression. Okay? I'm speaking now. I'm tying into my passion, my expression. That's giving. You can hear that. That's giving. If you're not receptive, it falls. And where's the giving? There's no giving. You cannot have one with you. It's our responsibility to receive, to allow others to give. And it's our responsibility to receive so that we can have stuff to give. So people who think that giving is first, it's not true. It's not true. That's what I teach.
Right.
I have a course called The Garden of the Soul. That's part of what I teach.
Yes. It's an interesting thought that one can perhaps meditate on, and perhaps it helps one to understand how to act in your own particular life.
Yeah. If people do meditate, I mean, I'm not a meditator per se, but if people do meditate and do breathing, just when you breathe out, think I'm giving. And when you breathe in, think I'm receiving. Just think that, give, receive for a while and see what it does to your consciousness and start to really feel that the breath is going on forever. Your words, your breath, your actions are going on forever. Then start to think about how responsible you are about in your giving and your receiving. It's a tremendous, tremendous responsibility. It becomes sacred. It becomes sacred.
What do you think about the law of attraction?
Okay, I don't ever use the word so much, only not because I don't believe in it, only because I think a lot of people don't get it, and I think a lot of people have commercialized it, and they think it's simply a matter of visualizing and putting affirmations out, and that's not my understanding of it. My understanding.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was going to say you're probably thinking about The Secret.
Yes, well, that's what most people think of when they think of it. But I do think by the same token, I think more and more people are becoming aware that that's not all it is. I mean, I work with many conscious entrepreneurs and authors and just people in general who more and more of them are understanding this is not quite what it is. To me, I don't like the word law, first of all, I think. But there is a principle of attraction, I'd say, where if you are – think of it like this. If you become yourself, if you are your true self, if we go back to that image of Dharma, because you are completely spiritualized, you become an irresistible force. You become so attractive. I mean, what is spirit? What is the ultimate divinity? The ultimate divinity, whether you believe in God, no matter what you call the divine, whether you say God, spirit, source, whoever, goddess, it doesn't matter. If ultimate truth is divine, ultimate truth is ultimately attractive. He, she, whatever is attractive. Everybody is attracted to that. Why? Because they are true. Because they are 100% true. There's no falseness. Everything is in this. And this being is being himself, his true self. I'm saying him for sake of language here. Okay, so pardon me. I'm not saying God's a he. Because we're not talking about bodies. So people are going to get hung up on words. I'm only using it to get over the language bit.
Right.
Divinity... If divinity is itself, I'll say it. If divinity is itself, it means that it is being its true nature. you are always attracted to things that are completely true natured. There's a tremendous charisma, tremendous attraction. There's no fuss with it. What I'm saying is you don't have to work at it. When you step into your dharma, watch what happens. When you identify the life purpose, and you can find this life purpose by listening. Listen to what, again, I have another course. I have a course on finding the hero of your own life, becoming the hero of your own life. And I say, listen to resonance, dissonance, and repetition. If you hear resonance in your life, if you hear dissonance at things that you're really angry about, or you hear things that keep coming again and again, these are indications of where you need to go. And when you finally go there and you step into that person, you become such an irresistible force. Believe me, when you fully step into your divine being, you're an irresistible force. And that to me is law of attraction. It's got nothing to do with setting goals and putting dream boards up and affirmations. It has to do with you standing in yourself. Nobody can resist you.
What I'm thinking is that you develop your spiritual side and perhaps you become more in harmony and balance with everything else. And through that, you actually attract more balance and harmony to yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll give you a really mundane example. This has got nothing to do with law of attraction per se, but it's a mundane example that you can apply as a metaphor to law of attraction. I'm a big social media addict, and I also train people in social media. I have 10,000 Twitter followers on my main account. Okay. Mm-hmm. What I have discovered yeah. This on Twitter and Facebook is the more people follow me, the more people want to follow me.
Yes.
Which is really bizarre. But it's the truth. And it's the same thing. I'm not saying that's law of attraction. What I'm saying is law of attraction, by way of metaphor, is that the more you become you, the more you become you, the more people want to know you. The more you like you, the more people want to like you. The more more you allow yourself to be seen, the more people want to see you. I have clients, book clients, some who I won't take on. I'll take them on to coach them, but I won't take them on to promote them on campaigns because I know they're not ready to be visible yet.
Right.
They're not ready yet, and I know that at least for me, I don't want to represent somebody who's hiding behind a veil. I want to represent people who are willing to take the veil off and say, "Here I am. Say what you want. Here I am," and stand really, really kind of naked in front of the world and say, "This is the real me now." Not belligerently, but with love. This is the real me. You either love me or not. And what usually happens, is when you're the real me, most people do love you, except for people who are really pretty messed up with their own issues. That's true.
Lynn, we are coming definitely into the last few minutes. I'd like you to take the opportunity to give our listeners your main website or any other ones that you feel are important.
Great. First of all, I want to say the whole name of my book. The name of the book is The Garden of the Soul, Lessons from Four Flowers That Unearth the Self. You can find it on Amazon anywhere. Any Amazon site. The Garden of the Soul, Lessons from Four Flowers That Unearth the Self. Be sure it's mine because there is another book out there called The Garden of the Soul with a different subtitle. So look for Lynn Serafin, and Lynn has two N's and Serafin has two N's. Now my main website is lynnserafin.com, lynnserafinn.com. I'm on Twitter under that name. I'm in Facebook under that name. And the other site I have is called spiritauthors.com. And Spirit Authors is a site where I have online training for authors to teach them how to write a book, how to promote your book. And I also do this is really pretty reasonably priced online training that you can take. And we do monthly calls, and you have audio downloads and workbooks and transcripts to work with. And I guide you through the process. And so you can go and take a look there. There's even a $1 like test drive that you can take for 7 days. So you can go over there. The other thing I would encourage people to do is please sign up for my newsletter, because those are two blogs, but sign up for my newsletter. It's on both sites. You'll see it on both sites, because I host, because I represent other authors, I do book promotions and management, campaign management for other authors. I'm representing Roy Martina from Hay House. We're going to do a huge launch. And I can't even tell you some of the people who are going to be on some of the virtual events we're going to be running. Sign up for my newsletter because you're going to want to be in touch to hear about some of these virtual events. And I have a massive program, viral campaign coming out called the Note Project with one of my clients that's going to be fantastic. And all this is coming up in the new year. So just follow me. Please just follow me. Connect with me on Twitter. Connect with me on Facebook. Connect with me on my blogs. Connect with me on the newsletter. And just follow me because you're going to have a lot of fun if you come to these events because I have some of the best authors on the planet. And we do amazing, amazing virtual events. So please just follow me. That's it.
Yeah. Right. Now you've got about a minute and a half to tell me what is the single most important message you want to leave with us today.
I can do it in less than a minute and a half. I'm not going to read it from my book, but this is the message. I've alluded to it before. You're already the hero of your own life. You're already the hero of your own life. You did not earn this title. You didn't have to. You were born the hero. It's your birthright. And if you open the book, if you go to Amazon and open the first few pages of the book, you can read the whole introduction that says that. And that's what I'd like to leave your listeners with tonight.
Right. So the hero is the one who is successful.
The hero is the one who steps into his dharma. A hero is the person who hears the call of their lives and steps into it.
Well, they might claim that if they can do that, they are a success, of course.
Yes, yeah, but it depends on how we define success.
Yes, of course. Yes. It must be a happy situation when you realize you have found your true self.
Absolutely. That's success to me. That's success to me. It is to me. And I feel successful.
As you said earlier, until you do, then life can be, I guess, a series of upheavals, and you keep getting the same lessons presented to you time and time again.
Yes, and that's the universe. That's the loving, compassionate universe's way of saying you're on the wrong path. Get back home. That's all it is. It's got nothing to do with punishments or bad luck. It's the universe saying, "Please come back to who you are." That's all it is. Listen, listen, just listen.
That's excellent, yes. The time's gone so quickly. You're excellent at speaking, I must say.
Thank you.
I actually had a 3-course meal while you were talking.
Well, I'm also a radio host, too. I know how it is when you... Oh, God. Oh, by the way, are we still on the air? If people want to hear...
Yes.
I do have a radio show. I don't talk as much on the radio show. I listen. I listen more. It's on Blog Talk Radio. Ooh, can I say that on your radio station? Can I say that?
I don't mind.
It's another network. Okay, it's on Blog Talk Radio. It's called Lynn Serafin's Garden of the Soul. And you must come this coming week because I'm interviewing Ian Skelly. Do you know who Ian Skelly is, Michael? He's from Radio 3. He's a broadcaster from Radio 3. He wrote a book, co-wrote a book with Prince Charles and Tony Juniper, who is also used to be from Friends of the Earth. And it's a fantastic book called Harmony. And it's about being connected to the earth and not. It's really Prince Charles's message about coming back to a sacred connection with the earth. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And Ian Skelly is going to be on my show Wednesday, 6 p.m. UK time, 1 p.m. Eastern. Right. Blog Talk Radio.
Do me a favor. Send me an email with those details. Well, look, thank you very much, Lynn. It's been terrific speaking with you. I will announce my guests for next week, who is Mystic Vajrayana. She claims she is a Pleiadian earth goddess. She is an enlightened life facilitator, a light bringer, and she claims to be a soul here to be instrumental in awakening humanity's upshifts into whole self-awareness and human self-enablement. And that's it for today. Thank you for being with me. It was terrifically enjoyable, and I hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.